Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series. First of all, apologies for the delay. We've been having some technical difficulties, so sorry about that to everyone. Today's session is entitled Developing a Cardio and Strength Training Program at Home After a Non-Traumatic Spinal Cord Injury. My name is Roberta Pesce, and I am the Research and Project Manager at the Transverse Myelitis Association. We are a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune diseases. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. Chitra Krishnan, Executive Director of the TMA, will be moderating our podcast today. A few housekeeping pieces before we start. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website at myelitis.org. And it can also be downloaded via iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, please send them to us via our Facebook page at facebook.com, or you can also use the raise your hand feature on the GoToWebinar if you have installed the GoToWebinar app, or send us a message through the chat option that is also available. So over to you, Chitra.
Great. Thank you, Roberta. Sorry again for the delay to everyone. Thanks for being patient. The 2015 TMA Ask the Expert podcast series is made possible in part through the generous support of Chugai Pharmaceutical Company and Alexion Pharmaceuticals Incorporated. Chugai Pharmaceutical Company is conducting clinical studies to create original and innovative drugs, both in the United States and overseas, to address unmet medical needs in neurological disorders where the level of pharmaceutical contribution and satisfaction concerning patient treatment remains low. Alexion Pharmaceuticals is a global pharmaceutical company focused on serving patients with severe and rare disorders through the innovation, development, and commercialization of life-transforming therapeutic products. Their goal to deliver medical breakthroughs where none currently exist is driven by the knowledge that people's lives depend on their work. Thank you to both our sponsors. For today's podcast, we're excited to be joined by Drs. Karen McCain and Melanie Farrar. Dr. Karen McCain is an associate professor in the School of Health Professions, as well as the associate director of the David M. Crowley Research and Rehabilitation Laboratory at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas. Dr. McCain maintains a clinical practice with a focus on gait recovery in persons with neurological injuries. In addition, she actively conducts research in the areas of gait recovery after stroke, as well as the impact of orthoses on gait in persons with neurologic diagnoses. Thank you, Dr. Karen McCain. Dr. Melanie Farrar graduated from physical therapy school with a Doctor of Physical Therapy degree at Southwestern Medical Center. She spent the following year as the neurologic physical therapy resident at UT Southwestern, where she specialized in treating gait disorders in individuals with injuries and disease of the nervous system. Dr. Farrar serves as the physical therapist in the Total Life Care Clinic at the UT Southwestern MS Center and in the Demyelinating Disease Clinic at Children's Medical Center, both in Dallas, Texas. Her research focus is of lower extremity bracing in individuals with demyelinating diseases. Thank you, Dr. Farrar, for joining us as well. So just to start us off, perhaps I can turn it over to you, Dr. McCain. You know, the topic that we're talking about is, you know, developing a cardio and strength training program at home. But before we sort of jump into developing a program at home, would you be willing to sort of give an overview of what it means to be diagnosed with a non-traumatic spinal cord injury like TM or NMO or ADEM, and how important exercise and physical therapy is to both recovery as well as to maintaining one's physical condition?
Well, obviously, exercise is what we're all about. Physical therapists, we value exercise almost just above anything. When you look at what the literature talks about exercise really is the key to sort of what we consider neuroplastic change. So when you have a non-traumatic injury like TM or ADEM or one of these other diagnoses that you mentioned, what we're looking for is recovery sort of at the cellular level. So recovery means rewiring of the nervous system and facilitation of new connections, if you will. And what the literature tells us is that exercise is probably the best way to do that. Now, there are certainly other ways that that happens, and your physician prescribes medications to help sort of facilitate that recovery. But what we're interested in is exercise to help facilitate that kind of recovery. So as soon as you're cleared by your physician, we're interested in getting you up and moving, because exercise is the best way to rewire your nervous system. So when you're in the hospital and when you're, as soon as you're possibly able, your physical therapist is, and your occupational therapist is going to get you up and get you moving, because we want to get that nervous system, particularly your spinal cord, to start to rewire and make new connections. So the sooner we can do that, the better, because most literature, again, would suggest sooner is better. So a lifelong sort of mindset of exercise is what we're after. Now, obviously, and we'll talk about this as we go through the broadcast, there are things we have to consider when you think about prescribing exercise. But exercise is really the best tool we have to fight the negative effects of inactivity and promoting that neuroplasticity and those new connections. Because obviously people with transverse myelitis and other neurological disorders have varying degrees of weakness and paralysis. Some people have mild deficits, some people have more profound deficits. But what we want to try to do is reestablish those connections, and the best way to do that is exercise.
Great, thank you. Dr. Farrar, so as a normal exercise routine, you know, everybody says you should do cardio 4 or 5 times a week, some strength training, and of course this changes when one is diagnosed with TM or NM or ADEM. But what is optimum given the level of complicated symptoms as well as the medications that one is on?
That's a really good question. I would say optimum, you know, we can talk generally about what might be optimum, but we also have to make that a unique to each individual sort of answer as well, because what might be optimum, if I'm just speaking generally, would be what is optimum for the general population. Mm-hmm. You know, like you just said, 4 to 5 days a week of cardio and do some strength training 2 to 3 days a week. But we also have to take in consideration, like you said, all of the ways in which this disease process or this attack has affected that individual's ability to respond appropriately to exercise. So I would just say, from a general standpoint, trying to incorporate exercise as part of a daily routine, as opposed to making it something that is separate from what you kind of do from the moment you wake up until the moment you go to bed, is one of the easiest ways, one of the, I think, best ways that we have to try to make it optimum for each individual from a general standpoint.
Great, thank you. So as you said, there are, of course, special considerations. So would you be able to sort of start elaborating on what are some of those special considerations that one must keep in mind?
Absolutely. I would say, you know, fatigue is probably one of the things that comes up most frequently when discussing exercise or physical activity outside of, you know, just kind of making it through the day physically. For a lot of folks who have had a TM event or something similar. So figuring out ways to manage fatigue with daily activities or with exercise is one of the biggest things. There's a large body of research, especially in the population of MS, of multiple sclerosis, that intermittent exercise is found to be, you know, just as effective or beneficial for those individuals as far as reaping the benefits of exercise. However, it allows them to have some sort of recovery in between shorter bouts of activity so that they're able to do more over a, you know, span of the day or a span of an exercise, still getting those benefits. So taking breaks frequently and throughout a training session or an exercise session is one of the biggest, best ways to help manage the fatigue component. Also, people may have heard about using cooling of some sort. So heat sensitivity is one way that people are often brought to fatigue more quickly. So a way to sort of kind of prevent that, or at least push the effects of that further off, are to do sort of cooling before you go do any sort of exercise. So taking a cold shower, drinking a really cold cup of ice water, using cooling equipment like cooling neck wraps, cooling vests, exercising in an air-conditioned environment if that's at all possible. Those things, I would say, are maybe the two best, biggest special considerations that I would have you think about.
Great, thank you. Dr. McCain, anything you'd like to add?
Well, I think just like Dr. Farrar said, I think the kind of weakness patterns that we're used to seeing, sometimes patients with TM or other similar disorders might have foot drop that makes it difficult for foot clearance. So sometimes special things like bracing, sometimes other assistive device things need to be considered. So sometimes just extra little adaptive devices, things like that can make exercise easier. I think you can't emphasize enough the idea that dispersing exercise throughout the day is oftentimes the best way to exercise when you're struggling with these kinds of disorders. Sometimes people get so focused on the fact that they have to, because prior to their illness they were used to going to the gym and working out, and they feel like if they don't get that big bout of exercise that they're not working out. And so sometimes they'll go and do a workout and then they'll overdo. And it's that overuse that you really want to avoid, because it's not good to go work yourself to death and then the next 2 days you can't get out of bed. That's very, very counterproductive in these kinds of disorders. So just like Dr. Farrar said, the idea of just thinking about activity throughout your day as being exercise. Because, for example, in our clinic, what we really do is try to get people to do what we call focused walking or focused exercise. So even if you break it up into, 10-minute bouts throughout the day, that's still exercise. And you can still get a cardiovascular workout in smaller chunks, if you will. So that just because you can't do a big chunk anymore doesn't mean that you're still not exercising. So we talk to people about using a rate of perceived exertion. So there's a rate of perceived exertion scale that you can educate patients on. The one we use, it goes from 6 to 20. 6 would be, you would rate a 6 as I'm sitting on the couch watching TV. 20, we tell patients that a 20 is climbing up a mountain. So we ask them to work in that 11 to 13 range, which is considered somewhat hard. So it feels like they're sort of, they're exerting themselves, but it's not so hard that they, can't catch their breath. So we give patients a visual scale to sort of grade the intensity of their exercise, but still doing it in small chunks throughout the day, which makes it more manageable. Because if you give somebody a task that's not doable, then they're not likely to exercise at all. And rather than make it, insurmountable for the patient, we'd much rather break it up in meaningful chunks that they can actually accomplish. And then as they get stronger, then they can do a little bit more. So breaking it up throughout the day is a very legitimate way to do it. And also giving people the tools, like I said, so maybe they have a walker with a seat on it, so they could walk for 5 minutes, and if they needed to sit, they could sit. So instead of getting out and they're like, oh my gosh, I need to sit and there's no place to sit. Things like that, just, again, those are the kinds of things a physical therapist can help you with, so that you don't get in a situation where you're, not prepared, if you will.
Great, thank you. Actually, again, I have a question from one of our members in our community, and I think you've partially answered it, or most of it. He says, I was diagnosed with acute idiopathic TM in 2009, C7 to T3. I'm now classified a high-functioning quadriplegic. I walk but have loss of bowel and bladder. I have numbness from the site of injury down and general muscle weakness. My arms and hands have significant dysfunction that I work around. Balance is fair, gait is fair, both declining during the day as my energy declines. I want to be as physically strong as possible, but I've also been told to conserve energy. How do I do both? And I think one of the points that he's bringing up is how the energy level declines during the day. So perhaps, Dr. Farrar, you could comment on how important it is, what time of the day one should work out as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So just to kind of add on, or maybe more specifically speak to this question based off what Dr. McCain just said, I think it is a great thing to want to be as physically active and as physically strong as possible, but that whoever, has told you to conserve energy, that is wise, that is good for you to be able to make it through your day. So I wouldn't necessarily say that a specific time of day is a general or across the board the answer, other than you know, usually people maybe first thing in the morning or earlier in the day may have more energy because they haven't used it on, you know, other activities throughout the day. However, just like Dr. McCain just went through, being able to kind of throughout the day. So, you know, if you are spending a day around your house and getting up to walk for 3 minutes or 5 minutes is putting you in that range of feeling like you're working moderately hard, then maybe make you get up to walk to go to the kitchen to get lunch prepared, or get up to walk to go to the restroom. Make those small trips be part of your exercise program. That is what Dr. McCain, I believe, was referring to when we come into this with the preconceived notion of I need to go to the gym and get my hour-long exercise session accomplished today or else I haven't exercised. What we want to encourage our patients and empower them with is that isn't necessary to get exercise that is beneficial for you. So figuring out a walking program or focused exercise can be built into your daily activities. That might just be, you know, walking across the house or walking, you know, if you live in an apartment complex, making a lap around the apartment, or making a short walk down the street if that's feasible for you. But all of those things, you know, short bouts that you know you can do, and you know you have a way to rest or stop as you need to, so that you can recover, and that is a way to conserve energy then throughout your day.
That's great. Thank you. So for those who are able to go to the gym and who are sort of able to use equipment, you know, are there any recommendations, do's and don'ts that you would suggest? I mean, for example, use a treadmill, but only do so much and not more. You know, is there a way to design something that if someone is able to go to the gym, what they can and should do and should not do? Dr. McCain?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of options there. There are, you know, some gyms that have trainers that you can access, and I say with a little bit of caution, some of the trainers are familiar with people that have some disease pathology. Some are not, so you do need to be just a little bit cautious, I would say. Some of the trainers are, you know, not so familiar. So it's worth asking your trainer if they have some specific knowledge about people that have a disease process. But a lot of them do. And so I would suggest a general sort of workout. The trick is to not overload. We are really, really, really big fans of treadmill walking. But again, you have to be super cautious. You don't want to get on a treadmill if you're not safe. So I would say to almost anybody without having seen them, don't get on a treadmill without holding on. Go at a really nice slow pace to make sure that you're 100% safe. Again, if you've got foot drop and you're not wearing to support your foot, not a good plan. I would not get on there and walk on that treadmill without making sure that someone was there with you the first time to make sure that you're 100% safe. Safety comes above everything else. If you can do that safely, then it's a really good place to start. I would, again, start small, start with 5 minutes, see how you feel, and I would start with a fairly low speed in the 0.7, 0.8 miles per hour. That's about as low as we like to go. Now, again, if that's too fast, you need to back it down. Everything has to be customized to what you can tolerate. But it's a great training tool because it's one of those things that's repetitive, and it gets good input to your spinal cord. So there's very good evidence in the literature about the benefits of treadmill training. It's one of those things that's very task specific. So it's one of the activities that we like to do to help send input to your spinal cord to help with that neuroplasticity or that rewiring that we talked about just a little bit ago. So it's a great activity, but it can also be a very dangerous environment. So it's one of those things you have to be very cautious about. Weight training is also a really good thing, but you have to be, again, very cautious that you don't overload the muscles. So I would say with a very conservative program, don't overload on the weight, but it's good to do just a general lower body, just the the big muscles, quadriceps, hamstrings, basic ankle muscles, hip extensors, hip flexors. But again, light on the weights, low reps. You're not going for aggressive. Same with the upper body, low weight, low reps to start with. And then you have to really be very tuned into your body and monitor your response to it. If the next day you feel extreme muscle soreness and you're completely exhausted, then you know you did too much. So the rule is to start light. Don't start heavy and then see how you respond. Start light. Go easy.
That's great. Thank you. We just got a question through GoToWebinar from Diane. She says, I'm concerned about developing cardiovascular disease because I could not even pass the stress test. What other things can we do?
You want to take that, Melanie?
Sure. So based on, can you repeat the question for me just so I make sure I understood it?
Sure. It said, I'm concerned about developing cardiovascular disease because I could not even pass the stress test. What other things can we do?
That is, so obviously we have to take our whole body, all of our systems into consideration. So this brings up a very good concern, a very realistic concern. I'm not exactly sure what the level of stress test or what type of stress test was performed. However, this is perhaps a question that this patient should bring to the cardiologist or the physician that he or she has seen that performed the stress test to figure out what are the safe ways that this person could put some stress on their body beneficially to be able to do at least some cardio activity. That may be something that is very highly modified, and it might be a seated exercise or something with only upper extremities or only lower extremities to not place too significant amount of stress on the body. However, I think with this kind of contraindication or near, kind of precaution in mind, speaking with that physician and doing a team approach to, what is allowed from the cardiovascular side based on those test results. And then, a rehab professional can provide the options based on what we know is acceptable or safe for this person.
That's great. Thank you.
I think that's a great answer. I think you have to be super cautious with respect to the physician's guideline because there could be underlying reasons why that individual didn't pass the stress test. But when you engage the upper extremities, it's usually easier to get the heart rate going a little bit faster than just the lower extremities. But sometimes you can do something like a recumbent bike where you can do the lower extremities and the upper extremities at the same time, and that can get the heart rate up a little bit faster. You can also do some swimming activities. And so once you get the physician clearance, then like Dr. Farrar said, you can get a rehab professional involved and get some ideas for other activities that might be easier and not so hard as far as physically, like walking really fast. Those are not going to be things that you might be able to do, but there are some other ways to get your heart rate up that once you've got that physician clearance that you might be able to do. Some activities just easier to get your heart rate up than others. And typically when you get the arms involved, like on an elliptical or a recumbent bike or swimming, doing things like that, you can probably get your heart rate into that target zone.
Great, thank you. And this is a question that we get asked all the time when we get calls from people or emails. People's insurance runs out or they only have X number of sessions that they can go to with a physical therapist or an occupational therapist, and then they're sort of, go home and that's it. Are there reliable resources or places or websites that you would recommend that they can go and either be able to get guidance or print out, the types of exercise one could do? I know it's sort of a difficult question because, when you don't have anybody to give you guidance, be it a trainer in the gym or a physical therapist, an occupational therapist, you certainly don't want to give up. So what should one continue to do at home? And you touched on this with the whole functional training, but are there specific exercises that one can follow, a sequence of exercises one can follow, for example, go to?
That's a good question, and I'll let Dr. Farrar follow up as well. I have not personally found a website that had what I would consider to be reliable information, only because sometimes they have either an agenda that they're pushing or a product that they're pushing, or it's very difficult to prescribe exercises for every population, particularly without seeing patients. What our perspective has always been when we look at functional exercises is the best exercise you can do is something that when you're using big functional muscles. So we prefer, if you can, to do exercises in standing. Those are your functional muscles or your lower extremity muscles. So exercises when you're doing sit to stand, standing leg exercises, coming up on your toes, stepping up on a step, bringing your leg out to the side, things like that, walking, those are your best exercises. Once you have to sit, then you're just not getting as much bang for your buck. And then when you're laying down, then you get even less bang for your buck. Now, sometimes those are the only exercises that you're able to do given your level of function. But the best exercises to do are the ones that when you're upright, moving your body against gravity. But as far as going to a website and saying, okay, what are the best exercises to do? I have not seen such a website. So our recommendations are to people to stay in the most functional position you can be, and we think that that's upright.
That's great. Thank you, Dr. Brown.
Yeah, sure. I'll just add on to that. I think definitely what Dr. McCain said, you know, remaining upright and being able to perform those exercises to get the most bang for your buck. Additionally, just like what we were speaking to earlier, something like a sit-to-stand, kind of a modified squat, if you will, if that makes a little bit more sense in your mind or trying to kind of visualize what we're talking about. But that works so many of your lower body muscles, and it also is something that we all do if we're able to get up and walk. We have to come from a sitting to a standing position. So like we've been talking about, that is functional, but it also can really work your muscles. So doing something as simple as that, but doing it multiple times, perhaps if you are going to get up to go walk to the restroom. So do 5 sit to stand, walk to the restroom, go, and you come back, do 5 more, and do that multiple times a day. Simple examples like that. Separately, though, just to kind of specifically answer another part of the question that you asked, Chitra, I would agree with Dr. McCain. I haven't found a website that I would point people to directly just to go find more specific exercises or an exercise program. However, if you are being seen by a physical therapist, even if it's not something that has come up, you know, in your sessions or as part of the evaluation that you went through initially, ask your physical therapist for exercises or for recommendations for something that you can do at home. This should be a two-way street. You should be able to voice your concerns and voice your requests and what you're hoping to get out of a program. I think you are often sold short if you're not able to be given something that that you can do a lot away from therapy. You shouldn't only be able to go to physical therapy to do exercises or walking or whatever you're working on there. You should be able to work as a partnership with your physical therapist to be able to have something that you're empowered with and take, you know, feel like you are safe and confident in whatever that is that you're able to work on away from your physical therapist.
That's great. Thank you. And I want to sort of jump into the, you know, what's the latest research that we know. Before we do, we just got another question. I've had TM for 5 years. I'm paralyzed but can walk with calipers and knee braces. Recently, I've started panting while walking. What regimen do you suggest? And I think you've already addressed this, both of you have, but Dr. Farrar, did you want to say anything additional?
So if you feel like you're panting or getting short of breath or starting to notice that you fatigue a little bit more quickly, rest might be the first answer, but maybe just from a more general medical perspective, just make sure you're considering all aspects of your physical body. If you feel like there might be another reason why you may be feeling that way or might be getting shorter of breath, then I would certainly recommend touching base with your physician about that, just to maybe be clear to make sure that there's nothing new going on. Apart from that, barring that all things are still okay, it may be that you took a short stay, you know, maybe you slowed down for a couple of months. You know, the summer months are really hard on people who have heat intolerance. So if you maybe took a break from what your normal daily routine was for 2 to 3 months, and you are coming back and expecting your body to do all of those things just as easily as before, just take a step back and give yourself a little bit of a break, and it's sort of like just resetting. So come back to that question of, you know, working to that moderate, medium, hard description, medium, hard level. If you feel like you're pushing yourself beyond that, try to get to a place of rest before that and see if you can recover more quickly and more easily, and then you can slowly build upon that.
Great, thank you. And so now, you know, a question that everybody wants to know, what is some of the latest research that's going on? You know, are there some research studies that you're involved with that you would like to share? Can we start with you, Dr. King?
Well, we are not currently in our clinic doing specific research in this area as far as exercise. There is a growing amount of research that looks at exercise in general, with patients with TM and other similar diseases. And it all points to the same thing. Research is the answer. I mean, exercise, rather, is the answer. It is absolutely the key to neuroplasticity. Now, there is also an enormous amount of work going on in other areas, such as, you know, remyelinating drugs and a whole lot of other things. But there still remains an enormous amount of research that suggests that exercise is critical for that rewiring of your nervous system. There have been studies, very hallmark studies, that looked at way back to the 80s and forward, looking at, for example, treadmill training and the benefits of just that repetitive input to your spinal cord that is critical for sprouting new axons and sending out new signals to your brain to reorganize the neurons in your spinal cord to make new connections, and that is still there. Now, again, there are also lots of studies going on looking at drugs and stem cells and other things to sort of facilitate that process, but none of those studies would suggest that without exercise that's going to happen. So in our particular lab, we're not doing any studies specifically looking at that, but every study that we do is an intervention embracing studies, for example, but always pairing that with exercise. We don't have one doubt at all in our minds that exercise is the key. So
that's great. Thank you, Dr. Farrar. Anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, sure. There, you know, I think I kind of pointed on this earlier, talking about the exercise of taking breaks throughout an exercise routine or throughout a day. But still getting the benefit, you know, even the cardiovascular benefit of exercise. That has been pretty well supported in the literature of MS research. However, there has been new evidence. I just read an article about a month ago that went through a similar study and basically asked the same question: Are we really benefiting from? Are patients really benefiting from this intermittent exercise versus a continuous exercise routine? And the answer is, again, yes, that is beneficial because they're still getting cardiovascular benefit, but they're also still having the chance to allow their body to cool down and recover and not get overheated as quickly.
That's great. Thank you. And we actually had another question from the community, and this was around what specific equipment, sports equipment, would you recommend besides a yoga mat, like stretch bands and things like that? Would you recommend those for therapy?
I would say that, yeah, absolutely. I'll touch on that a little bit. I hate to be the person that keeps saying, well, generally versus specifically, but that question again would just depend on what it is that we're talking about. So from a functional activity sort of standpoint. If we're trying to get to just the bare bones, what if you are able to get into a standing position, and if you're able to walk safely, I think you can do a lot of exercises with minimal equipment, thankfully. So that should be good news, hopefully, to folks out there. TheraBands can definitely be helpful to add some resistance to some of those standing exercises, or to do some upper body strengthening exercises as well. But just from a, like I said, kind of just a general standpoint, the good news is that you don't really necessarily have to have any other piece of equipment to be able to do a lot of these kind of functional exercises.
That's great. Thank you. So Dr. Farrar, just, and we've both touched on this already and have spoken to it about how important exercise is, you know, to recovery, but how long do you think can one continue to recover function with continued physical activity? I mean, is there a time frame? And we get asked this all the time. Does someone plateau mm-hmm. out because they're not seeing any change?
Yeah, that is a really good question. And I would say, you know, just like the general population is never really immune to separated out from these kind of suggestions of general activity and exercise recommendations, that recommendation would go for the population that we're addressing today as well. So, you know, continuing to exercise is a lifelong commitment. As you know, we want it to be part of your lifestyle, as opposed to, you know, something that you think is temporary and just as part of an expected, you know, maybe certain number of years time frame to get to a certain point of recovery. You may notice that you get to points of plateau, and that might be where you call to question, you know, maybe what is my routine? And that's where going back to a rehab professional, like a physical therapist, an occupational therapist, would be a great, they would be a great resource for you, because you can come back and say, you know, these are the things I'm working on. I don't feel like they're benefiting me anymore. And how can we change this up? Those are certainly beneficial for anyone who may have this question. And that's where rehab professionals can really be the most helpful for you. So you may run out of benefits in it, you know, for a certain year or time frame, and then might be, you know, on your own. But there's certainly a benefit to and an understanding to the knowing that 6 months from that point, you may benefit from being evaluated again and making up some new goals, setting some new goals, changing your plan so that you can kind of refocus what your goal might be.
Great, thank you. Dr. McCain, question for you. Can activity trigger a relapse?
I'm sorry, can what?
Can activity trigger a relapse?
No, I really don't. I don't think there's any literature to support that. As far as what I've read in the evidence, I don't think that it can. I'm much more concerned about inactivity than I am activity. I think what we need to do is we need to be smart and do the kinds of things that we've talked about so far as, you know, modulating your activity. I think you can overdo it. Now, I don't think that will trigger necessarily a relapse. I think you can slow yourself down by having to waste time recovering from working too hard, by getting muscles too sore and things like that. But I'm much more concerned about inactivity, because just like Dr. Farrar said, you know, we don't know what the timeline is for recovery. We don't know, you know, how far out people can continue to recovery. But we know what the effects are of inactivity. And we know that if recovery is going to happen, that you need to be ready, if you will, for recovery. You need for your muscles to be strengthened. You need for them to be lengthened. You know, if you don't engage in activity, your muscles become short and tight, and there are secondary effects of immobility and inactivity. And if you're not engaging in the routine that your rehab professional, your physical therapist, your occupational therapist have given you, then you're not going to be ready, if you will, for that recovery. So assuming you're doing the activity that's been prescribed to you, then no, I don't think you need to worry about producing a relapse. Like I say, I think you need to be much more concerned about engaging in inactivity than activity.
That's great. Thank you. Dr. Farrar, any thoughts you'd like to add on this question?
No, I would totally agree with what Dr. McCain said. I think oftentimes there may be concern of am I doing too much or am I going to, cause myself to have a relapse or an exacerbation of some sort. As well as you can listen to your body in these activities, but moving when you can is certainly our vote if it's a possibility. So yeah, we want activity and want to stave off inactivity as frequently and as consistently as possible.
Great, thank you. And as both of you said, it's important to manage fatigue, manage, overheating, using a cooling device, because, often it's just, you'd feel like your symptoms are worsening, but that's, it can be managed so you can continue to exercise as long as you are mindful of it.
Absolutely.
Great, thank you. We got another question that just came in, sort of a follow-up to a previous one from one of our listeners. What do you think about hand cycling? Is that a good form of exercise?
I think it can be. I think, again, like we mentioned before, hand cycling, when you use your arms, your upper extremities, you can absolutely increase your heart rate. It is a way to increase your heart rate, and if that is a form of exercise that's available to you, again, assuming that you're doing it within reason and within your capability, it absolutely is a way to get your heart rate up. And if you're not able to use your lower extremities for exercise, it absolutely is an option. Again, you need to follow, caution, and you don't want to put your arms in a position where you're going to overwork your shoulders or put yourself in a position that you could injure yourself, but there's a place for it, and you absolutely can get a good workout.
That's great, thank you. And both of you talked about rate of perceived exertion. Is there a way you can explain how one can test that out at home? Like, what does one do to, is it just it's a subjective scale?
It is a subjective scale, but it actually correlates. There's been an enormous amount of research that has correlated the rate of perceived exertion with actual heart rate. So if you were to, now again, this is a little bit, this can be a little bit dicey if you're dealing with people that are on medications for, beta blockers and other kinds of things. But if you took a basic kind of age, which is 220 minus your age, okay, that's heart rate maximum. So if you were 50 years old, if you took 220 minus 50, that would give you 170. That's your age predicted heart rate maximum. Okay, so if you wanted to work in an aerobic level, you would take anywhere between, and you can modulate this based on your activity needs. You could take anywhere between 70% and 85% of that as a target heart rate. So you would take 170 and take maybe 70% of that. And I am not smart enough to do that without a calculator. So let me figure out what that is. I'd love to. I'm pretty sure I got 220 minus 50 correct. 170, thank goodness. Okay, 170 times. That's so very sad, isn't it? Okay, so a target heart rate, if you took 70% of that, would be 119. So if you look at the rate of perceived exertion, if you're working in that hard, fairly hard, which is 11 to 13 on that scale, if you took your heart rate, it should be close to that 70%. It should be in the 119, 120, 125 range. So it should correlate pretty well to a 70 to 75% of your age predicted heart rate maximum. And there have been a ton of studies that have taken that rate of perceived exertion and correlated it remarkably well to the number that you pick on that scale. So if you work in that fairly hard range, your heart rate should be in your target heart rate zone. So if you want to take your pulse, you should be in about 70, anywhere between 70 and 85% of your target heart rate. So if you take your pulse, then then you should be pretty close to what you would be considered in that 70 to 80, 85% of your age predicted target heart rate zone. So there is a way to check it. You can actually take your heart rate. So you can take it at your wrist pulse, or you can take it on your carotid artery, right on your neck. So if you don't know how to take your pulse, there's a zillion websites that you could figure out how to do that.
That's great. Thank you for giving us a more detailed explanation on our PE. As we're approaching the 1 hour mark, I would love sort of take home messages from both of you, sort of what you'd want our listeners to take home as three key points that we've learned from this webinar podcast. Dr. Farrar, can we start with you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think hopefully what kind of the theme has become over this hour is talking about activity, right? So choose movement when you can, choose activity as opposed to sitting still or inactivity. But with that said, the caveat is, break it up throughout your day, or if you do have a specific exercise session that you're working on, break it up throughout that. So activity is key, and doing it broken up throughout the day to allow for recovery is also key. Those would be my two big take-homes.
Thank you, Dr. McCain.
I would 100% agree with that. The other thing I would probably add is start small, be safe, and find yourself a knowledgeable physical therapist who can help you with the right kinds of tools to make it possible. Sometimes I think our clients don't get the right tools, and so they don't engage in activity because they don't have the things that they need. Either they don't have the assisted device, maybe the right kind of walker, maybe something with a seat, or they don't have maybe the right kind of bracing, which would really improve their walking ability and make it possible for them to exercise. And I think they're working too hard. If they had the right tools, I think it might be so much easier to engage in activity. And set reasonable goals. You may have been used to going to the gym and working out at an hour at a time, and if you can't do that, then you're discouraged and you don't want to do it. So with the help of your rehab professional, set reasonable goals, and then just be super excited when you reach those. And then you can set a little bit higher goal. But when you set those little goals and you reach them, then you're so, and it keeps you on track and it keeps you going.
Thank you both for your very positive messages. Thank you for giving us an hour of your time answering our questions. And thank you for taking care of our community and being there for patients with TM, NMO, and ADAM. We really, really appreciate your time and energy and passion. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's our pleasure. Mm-hmm.